Welcome to Detroit Opera's Opera Here podcast. This is Arthur White coming to you from the Detroit Opera House. Joining me today is Associate Artistic Director of Detroit Opera and the greatest Wagnerian soprano of our days, Miss Christine Gerke. Thank you so much for being here today.
Oh my gosh, it's a pleasure to be here with you all, and apparently you are my new PR person. Welcome to our listeners. We are really thrilled that you've joined us today as we are going to take a look at the opera Breaking the Waves by American composer Missy Mazzoli. This will be the first time that Detroit Opera has presented Breaking the Waves, and it also marks the first opera by a female composer that we've presented on our main stage. So I am particularly excited about this particular work. So today we're going to speak a bit about the opera's background, what we can all expect to see in this particular production, and hear from the composer, Missy Mazzoli herself, about bringing this story from the screen to the operatic stage. Breaking the Waves is opening on April 6th and runs through April 14th at the Detroit Opera House.
Missy Mazzoli's Breaking the Waves is an opera in three acts, which was commissioned and premiered on September 22nd, 2016, by Opera Philadelphia. The libretto by Royce Fabric is based on the 1996 film of the same name by the Danish film director Lars von Trier. Breaking the Waves has been widely acclaimed by critics as a major success. It won the inaugural Best New Opera Award from the Music Critics Association of North America, and Opera News proclaimed, "The opera stands among the best 21st century American operas yet produced."
I happen to agree. I think this piece is incredible. This new production of Breaking the Waves by Tom Morris, it's a co-production between Opera Ventures, Scottish Opera, Houston Grand Opera, the Adelaide Festival, and the, ready for this, Théâtre National de l'Opéra Comique. I just wanted to sound fancy. Our opera is set in the Scottish Highlands during the early 1970s. It tells the story of Bess McNeil, who is a religious young woman with a very deep love for Jan, a handsome oil rig worker. Bess is at odds with the elders of her Presbyterian Calvinist church because Jan is a Norwegian and not a churchgoer, and an outsider, but the elders eventually agree to their marriage. Not long into their marriage, Jan becomes almost completely paralyzed from an offshore rig accident. Now, while Jan knows that his wife would never step outside of their marital covenant, he does not want Bess to feel trapped in a marriage with no physical intimacy. This is important to him. So Jan encourages her to seek other lovers. When she refuses, Jan tries to commit suicide, and only then does Bess agree to obey her husband's request. When Bess does have sex with a man that she encounters, Jan's health magically improves, and she becomes convinced that she alone can heal Jan. Word gets around that Bess is committing adultery, and now Bess is excommunicated from her church. This all leads to a finale of sacrifice, divine grace, and all of this comes at a great cost. Now, we have discussed amongst ourselves whether or not we should mention that there is an advisory attached to this piece in this particular production. And we've decided to go forward with this, and we want to discuss why. I will tell you what the advisory is. This production includes explicit language, nudity, and sexual content, some of which is that of a violent nature. And we are recommending this piece for mature audiences only. Now, there are so many ways that opera is disturbing. And we mention these things because it is blatant in this production, in this story. But there are other stories that are equally as disturbing. I play the role of Electra, and all she is determined to do is kill her mother and avenge her father's death with an axe. This is disturbing. We think of Rigoletto, and poor Gilda shows up in a bag. This is disturbing, but when it is somehow in another language, it feels as though there's a bit of a pretty wrapper on it. And so it potentially isn't as hurtful or impactful as something that is very blatant can be. And that is why we decided to bring this up. I mean, Arthur, how do you feel about that, the contrast?
I completely agree with what you're saying. I think there is something about these pieces somehow maybe being grandfathered in, because now we've considered them, you know, these fantastic great works from the past. We don't question these stories. We know their stories. But now that we're bringing something, you know, more contemporary, something in English, something coming from out of our society, now we're a little more hesitant. We see how these advisories are before we watch movies, or if we're all watching our favorite Netflix series, they'll come on with these advisories. So I think we've kind of, it's kind of become a part of our lexicon right now in today's society. But I think we don't look at them, the older pieces, that way, because they're kind of, I think they're grandfathered in our minds, I think.
I agree with you. I think that also this is the new way we are looking at our art form. This, I love to tell this to people, this is not your grandmother's opera, you know, and we have the opportunity to incorporate other ways of telling our stories and to address themes that are impactful on society. This theme is impactful on society. And I will throw in a quote that I love, and that is from Cesar Cruz. Art should comfort the disturbed and disturb the comfortable. And this piece disturbs and comforts me. So I am very excited that it is coming here.
Wow. I wanted to probably give some context. You know, this season themes have been, you know, collision and collide. And of course, when we talk about collision, we're talking about these characters like Madama Butterfly when we opened the season, who kind of break away from societal norms. And definitely Bess McNeil, in this case, also breaks away. But both in these societies where we're feeling women have no power or agency, but somehow they find agency, you know, within their particular heroism, I guess. But in the same respect, they both end up being martyrs at the end. So I'm kind of conflicted about how I feel about Bess's journey. I respect her going in and going her own way. That everyone is telling her what to do. Her husband is telling her what to do. Her church is telling her what to do. Her in-laws are telling her what she should be doing. And she does go her own way, and I really respect that. But then I also, it still is heartbreaking that she still ends up being sort of the martyr at the end of this. I'm not sure what
your thoughts are. Spoiler alert, she is, by the way.
Oh, yeah. Sorry about that, if I gave that away.
That's okay. I mean, look, the thing is, you bring up both Cho-Cho-San and Bess and say that they are martyrs. Yes, we can look at it that way. But with Cho-Cho-San, she is taking immense agency, but this is her decision. So this is her decision to be honored and to die with honor. And so do we regret that this happened? Of course. But there is immense agency that comes with that decision. And as far as Bess goes, you know, it's definitely happening, this particular story, in a very insular community in Scotland. But this story takes place in the 1970s when women were demanding equal rights all over the world, and this movement began. And so this all ties into exactly the same thing. So is it being martyred, or is it taking control of her life and doing what she feels is best? Is there something that is less of a martyr and more a woman in control of her own destiny?
You know what, Christine? You just changed my mind. I'm serious. I was really kind of grappling with that, but you're right. They have still decided what path they're going to take, regardless. Yeah. That's the path that they've chosen, and we have to accept that.
We might not have chosen those paths, certainly. But I mean, you know, that's not, when we choose to go on a journey, whether we're reading a book or seeing a movie or going to a play or coming to the opera, we are along for the ride. And opera is a place that is for big ideas and big emotions. And sometimes it asks us questions of ourselves that we leave the theater considering. And if we do that, we've done our job.
Yeah, I think that's why I've been particularly loving this season, starting with Matthew Ozawa's Butterfly, which for the first time, I never thought about Butterfly. I just came to listen to the great music. I felt sorry for her. I usually dropped a tear or two every time I saw Butterfly. But now all of a sudden, I'm starting to think about, how do we treat each other in society? You know what I mean?
Exactly.
How do we view things? How do we view others? How do we relate to our neighbors? Those people who are the other, for example. And so it's really interesting how I've gone on a journey myself. Not that I feel like I'm on the couch here, Christine. Going from opera, loving it just because of the music. But now all of a sudden, I'm really starting to question these things that I've loved all these years and never really thought as deeply about as I probably should have, how they relate to my life today, you know?
Well, I don't think that there's a should, but I mean, that is the beautiful thing about art in general. It can make an impact on us immediately, or we can wander away and then a week later, all of a sudden, come up with these immensely deep thoughts that thought you think, okay, well, I saw this great thing and it was beautiful and I love that music and it's too bad that, you know, Cho-Cho-San was a martyr in the end. And then a week later, you start thinking, wait a minute. And that's the beauty of what we do. If we give people the opportunity to consider and reconsider and rethink and come back and see it again and have another experience, everything is about the experience and being in that moment. It is an art form that does speak to society today.
And I think that's the reason why we find ourselves coming back to some of these works year after year, decade after decade, and now century to century, no doubt.
I think it would be great for us to just talk about the fact that since this is a story that is a difficult story, especially for the lead character, who's a woman, that we have gone out of our way to put together a team. It's led by, we have Stephanie Childress on the podium. We have Diana Wen, who is the revival director. We have Kira Duffy singing bass, who the role was written for when it premiered in 2016. It was important for us to make sure that telling this story that is difficult for everyone in the room, that we put women in places of creative power. So everyone feels that it is almost a maternal atmosphere, which I was very happy to see. We are so excited because the people who are coming in, Stephanie Childress is an amazingly talented conductor, and we're so lucky to have her. It is her debut here. I believe it's her debut in the United States, but it is certainly her debut here in Detroit. And she is one of the fastest rising conductors in the business today. So it is remarkable to have her. This production is important. Having Kira involved as well, coming back as Bess McNeil in a different production than she did the first time. She is so excited about this. And so I can't wait to see what the combination of all of these female brains in the room create with this piece, because that is different than what happened last time.
I applaud the intentionality, and I too am excited to see Kira Duffy. I got a chance to see an archival video of her doing her stuff at the premiere. It's going to be wonderful to see where she's come for in these few years, where this role is now for her. So I can't wait
Absolutely.
To see it as well.
So I know that we talked about the fact that this piece premiered in September of 2016 in Philadelphia. At the time, I was actually in Philadelphia because I was singing a run of Turandot at Opera Philadelphia, which is where this piece premiered. So I knew that the piece was premiering. A lot of my colleagues and friends were involved. I heard such amazing things about the composer and librettist team of Mazzoli and Vavrick, so I decided to go to the final dress. I didn't know anything about the story, hadn't seen the film, I still haven't. My reaction when this piece was over, I remember very clearly sitting in stunned silence along with everyone else who had just experienced this work for the first time. It was very big. I had big emotions, big thoughts, big sadness. And I left thinking about the immensity of grace and moreover, what I would do to save someone that I loved. And is there anything that I wouldn't do? And I was destroyed. I stood up when the lights came up and people were sobbing. And I just thought, this is important. And seeing this piece, it changed the way that I look at works being composed today and the kind of stories that we can tell and what opera can handle. And what does that mean? The kind of immense, oppressive stories that affect our lives every single day, that happen every single day today. We can tell these stories, and we can do that with an underscoring of music that makes everything even more impactful. And the orchestration for this piece, the clarity, the decisions made for as far as which voices would sing what, how would people be addressed? What kind of high-flying writing would express joy or sadness? And in this piece, everything was sort of one level up from anything that I had paid attention to before. And I went to 5 of 6 performances, not including the dress rehearsal, because this piece impacted me so much. So I cannot urge you all to please step out of your comfort zone if you think this is out of your comfort zone. Please come see this piece. Come experience this piece and this story. Hear this music and come on this journey with us, because it is immense.
Wow, Christine, I had no idea you had a history with the piece. I guess we had never spoken about this before. That's fantastic. I think this is one of the reasons why we see so many operas, new operas, coming out of America than any place else. It's time for us to tell our stories. We love the stories that we've gotten from the past and from Europe and that we've passed down, and we love them, but it's time to tell our stories. And I think this is why you probably see this explosion of writing coming out of the United States right now. I think it's just amazing.
I agree with you completely. I mean, you know, opera is a European art form, and I am so proud that we are able to partake in that and to continue to perform these operas. But the way that we create what is ours is to tell our stories, to tell stories that relate to what is happening in our world today. And American composers are having their day. I think it's long overdue, so I'm very, very proud to have this piece here in Detroit.
Missy Mazzoli is an American composer, pianist, and educator who has found acclaim for her chamber, orchestral, and operatic works. She hails from Lansdale, Pennsylvania, which is just outside of Philadelphia. She received a bachelor's degree from Boston University's College of Fine Arts, a master's degree from the Yale School of Music, and additionally studied at the Royal Conservatory of The Hague. She was named Artist in Residence for Opera Philadelphia and was named the Mead Composer in Residence with Chicago Symphony Orchestra. Her music has been performed by Opera Philadelphia, Scottish Opera, Opera Comique, LA Opera, Cincinnati Opera, the New York Philharmonic, LA Philharmonic, the BBC Symphony, the Sydney Symphony, the Detroit Symphony Orchestra, and so many others. And earlier this year, she was nominated for 2 Grammys for her album Dark with Excessive Bright. We are thrilled she is here. Missy Mazzoli, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Obviously, of course, we're talking about the production, which is coming, Breaking the Waves. I would just ask first, we know that the opera, we talked about this, that it premiered at Opera Philadelphia in 2016, but you actually began working on this opera back in 2014. Just wondering, how did this all come about?
So, yeah, I was composer in residence at Opera Philadelphia from 2012 to 2015. And during my residency, I really just wanted to start writing an opera. You know, I was studying a lot of opera. I was going to all the dress rehearsals and all the performances at Opera Philadelphia. And I really wanted to create my own work. I felt like I was ready for that. So about halfway through my residency, I pitched this idea of adapting Breaking the Waves to Opera Philadelphia. And to their credit, they really went with it right away, even though I had not done something on that scale. And were very supportive of my working with my longtime collaborator, Royce Favrick, on this. Yeah, and the rest is kind of history. I mean, it really, I see it as a sort of turning point in my career. Like, making this opera really changed everything for me in terms of, you know, visibility and just feeling confident that I had something to say in this medium and could pull it off.
Wow. You mentioned Royce, your librettist. I believe he's collaborated with you at least 5 of your 6 operas, I believe. You're sort of like a modern day Mozart da Ponte or a Gilbert and Sullivan. I don't know. This partnership. Can you talk a little bit more? How did you start working together?
So we met in Carnegie Hall in 2009. And we just met in the lobby. I was there to see a piece by our mutual friend, David T. Little, that Royce had written the text for. And this was a sort of a version of his opera Dog Days. And so I was there to support David. But then I heard this text and I thought, you know, what is this? This is really extraordinary. You know, it was a text for an opera, but there were, you know, teenagers and like talking about drinking and like, and I don't know. It had this like really modern young feeling to it. So I went up to Royce after the show and I said, I really loved that. You know, I gave him a flyer for a work in progress showing of my first opera, Song from the Uproar. And so he came to that showing and, you know, and then we got lunch and again, the rest is history. That began a, you know, now what is it? 15 year partnership. And here we are, you know, about 6 operas in. And It's been one of the great creative partnerships of my life.
Fantastic. Now, I understand it was he also who was really, I guess he had seen the Von Trier film and was also kind of really excited about working on this. Can you talk about that?
Sure. So yeah, it was Royce who suggested we adapt this film. You know, he had seen the film when he was 14, which is way, way too young to see this film. But he, it really was something that had stayed with him since, you know, his adolescence. And he was really insistent that this would make a great opera. I was at first nervous because there's a lot of sexuality, there's a lot of violence, there's a lot of really heavy stuff in the opera. And I didn't at first see a way into it, but then it was an idea that wouldn't leave me alone. And I kept thinking about this and thinking about how I could make it my own and make it unique. So I'm glad we stuck with it.
Wow. So, you know, we often see on the operatic stage, you know, plays or novels that were brought to the stage. But in this case, this was a film that came to the stage. Wondering, were there any particular challenges sort of going from one medium to the other as opposed to the other ways this trip typically done?
Yeah, you know, but I mean, I think that there are a lot of film adaptations happening these days. And I think that if, you know, Puccini and Verdi had had access to film, they would have been adapting films too. I don't think the process is so different. I think you just have to make a decision when adapting a film, if you're, how much of the original material are going to kind of keep in there. With Breaking the Waves, it was easy for me because there's not a soundtrack to that film. There are some moments when diegetic music appears. So like there's a wedding scene, there's a wedding band in the scene and you hear that music, but there's not sort of underscoring that's leading you emotionally or kind of telling you what to feel. So that was really liberating for me in that I could create my own psychological layer through the music that was not there in the film, just by virtue of the medium and also Lars von Trier's style of filmmaking. But yeah, I think that there's, you know, film often creates its own world, its own multimedia world. And so you have to decide as an opera maker how much of that you want to keep in there.
So we spoke before you came on a bit about Bess McNeil and this character. Who, in your mind, who is this character? Who is this woman?
Well, Bess is a lot of things. You know, on the surface, she's a young woman in her early 20s. She's very devout. She's a little bit naive just by virtue of having grown up in this sort of enclosed Calvinist community in the 1970s. And we firmly kind of, the film kind of doesn't tell you exactly where it's taking place. You know, it's taking place in the Scottish Highlands, but it's not very specific. So we firmly placed it on the Isle of Skye, where much of the film was shot. So anyway, so Bess is growing up there in the 70s. It's a kind of isolated place. And she's very influenced by the church, and in particular, these church elders who appear throughout the film and throughout the opera, who have incredible influence over the people in this community, particularly the women. But I think that in a broader sense, Bess stands for women everywhere. I think that her situation, first of all, it's fiction. You know, this is not a true story. This is an extreme dramatized version of things that women go through all the time. So I see Bess as sort of a, you know, a symbol of women in impossible situations where everyone around them is telling them what to do. Everyone around Bess is telling her what to do. These church elders are telling her what to do. Her mother, her sister-in-law, her husband, God, everyone has an opinion about her behavior. And that to me really resonated when I saw this film. And the further I dug into this film, I was like, oh, that, I think that's the approach I'm going to take with this opera. Is that it's a woman surrounded by people telling her what to do, and they're all telling her different things. So I think that, you know, you can look at the story from a lot of different levels, but I hope that people will see Bess as a sort of universal symbol of a particular aspect of the female experience.
You know, Missy, I'm so reminded of how we opened the season this fall with a new production of Butterfly, directed by Matthew Ozawa. And in this case, we saw Cho Cho-san, just like Bess, restricted in her choices by, you know, society and its norms, but both these ladies find the agency of choice anyway. Can you talk more about that? You know, how you found those, you know, how you musically sort of helped her find those choices, or maybe made those choices more realized?
Yeah, like I think that, I mean, I'm approaching the whole opera from Bess's perspective, you know, and so. You know, how do you give someone agency through music? It's not a very direct path. But I think that in terms of the whole picture, the staging, the set design, the way that Tom Morris has staged this, the way that every single aspect of the show amplifies the idea that this is from Bess's perspective. And that was my idea from the beginning, and that's what I've stuck with, you know. So everything from who's leading the way with these vocal lines and, you know, to how the staging is set up reflects that.
Tell us about how you captured this musically, the sort of the Scottish Highlands of the 1970s. I understand you made a trip there as you were writing.
Yes. So I went to Scotland in 2014 with my librettist, Royce Vavrick, and that was the first time I'd ever been to Scotland. And I was really struck by the contrast in the landscape. So Scotland is a place where you have like rolling hills that then crash into the sea, and then these jutting rock formations that stick out of the ground and in this really unexpected and almost sort of violent way. And so when we were taking a walk, and I heard the first chord of the opera in my mind during that walk. And it's this big sort of crashing chord. And it was directly inspired by the Scottish landscape and the landscape of the Isle of Skye. So, and this is, I'm someone who's not so inspired by nature all the time. I mean, there are composers who take great inspiration from it, but I'm someone who's always been more inspired by human drama. But this was one of the few times when the natural landscape really led me to have some musical ideas.
Wow. And I also understand in the orchestra, we have an electric guitar, and you were sort of trying to sort of emulate bagpipes. I understand. Could you talk about that?
Sure. Yeah. You know, I wanted to firmly place this in Scotland in some ways, but also have an element of the supernatural, you know. So I love the sound of bagpipes. I just think it's such a strange and particular instrument, but I didn't want to have bagpipes in the orchestra. That would be impossible, or would make it very difficult to have future performances. But I kind of emulated the sound of bagpipes through the orchestra itself. You know, and I created sort of drony textures and melodies that kind of go on top of them, and was inspired by that. And also by the tradition of Gaelic psalms, which is a typical style of liturgical singing from the Scottish Highlands, where a minister sings a line of text and then a congregation responds, but they don't all respond at the same time. It's a very sort of personal response that is sort of between you and God. So the effect is this sort of wash of sound, where everyone's singing the same melody, but at slightly different times. And so I emulated that in Act Three with the men's chorus.
Fantastic. Can you talk to us, you kind of touched on this earlier, but can you go a little further talking about the role of faith in this opera, particularly about Beth's faith? And as she tries to sort of square her Calvinist, you know, beliefs with trying to be true to herself, even at the cost of excommunication.
Yeah, I mean, this is one of the big questions of the opera is, you know, what is the nature of faith? What are the limits of faith? Does faith have limits? Bess is a very devout young woman. I mean, she spends her weekends cleaning the church and, you know, has this kind of running conversation with God. But what happens, you know, when God says to you, you shall obey your husband? You know, the husband is the head of the wife, just as Christ is head of the church. I mean, those are direct quotes from Calvinist wedding vows that we put into the opera. And, you know, when God is telling you that, but then your husband is telling you, in Bess's case, you know, to go out and be with other men in this sort of attempt to set her free. But that activity is obviously against the teachings of the church. So what are you left with? Who do you follow? You know, when God is telling you one thing, the church is telling you one thing, your husband's telling you another thing, and all these things contradict each other. And this is, again, I think this is an extreme dramatized version of a situation that many people find themselves in, but particularly many women find themselves in, the conflicts of serving a family, serving a church, serving God, and serving oneself. And it's kind of impossible to do everything. So I was really interested in this story, which sort of tests the limits of faith. And for someone who takes her faith very literally, I mean, Bess is absorbing everything that these church elders are saying, everything God is saying to her, everything her husband is saying, and she's taking it all very literally. You know, what is a person supposed to do in an extreme situation like the one that she finds herself in, where her husband has been in this horrible accident.
Can you talk to us about how you sort of handled some of those, that relationship between God and Beth? She talks to God, she prays, and she sort of has a conversation with God. I wonder if you could talk about how you handled that musically. I think it's really interesting.
Yeah, so, you know, those are some of my favorite scenes in the film, or when Beth talks to God, she prays out loud. But then the interesting thing is that she answers in God's voice. So, you know, she's saying, "Oh God, tell me what to do." And God will say, "Remember to be a good girl." And then she'll say it in the sort of masculine, authoritative voice. And it's such a strange moment in the film. And I thought, wow, I could really do something with this in the opera. So in the opera, you know, Bess sings a question to herself as she's talking to God, and or a question for God rather. And then when God answers, she sings very low, and then the men of the chorus echo her. So it's this very strange moment. That's also when we hear the electric guitar. The only time we hear the electric guitar in the piece is when God is speaking to her, because I wanted to have a sound in the orchestra that was just for the voice of God. And of course, it's the guitar.
Fantastic. Earlier, I heard you talking about sort of exploring the ideas of goodness in all of the characters, that things aren't always as simple as, you know, Tosca good, Scarpia bad, you know. Can you talk about the goodness in all the characters, even though sometimes they may seem the opposite to us when we're watching?
Sure. You know, so this was an idea that came directly from Lars von Trier. You know, in writing about the film Breaking the Waves, you know, he said that he wanted to make a film about goodness, and a film in which all the characters are acting in the way that they think is the most good. Like they truly believe that they are 100% on the path of, doing the right thing and doing the good thing for themselves and the community, yet still everything falls apart. And how we get from point A to point B, I think, is very interesting and very real and very close to our human experience. I mean, rarely in life are people clearly the villains, or, you know, they're rarely completely good or completely bad. You know, it's often much more confusing. So yeah, I think that everyone in this opera is doing what they feel is the most good, particularly for Bess and for the community. So the church elders and the minister, you know, they're trying to protect Bess from doing things that could harm her. Her husband, Jan, is, you know, he's telling her, once he's been paralyzed in this accident, he tells her to go and be with other men. And this is, you know, obviously a little misguided, but I think that he is truly trying to set her free and to keep her from a life where she is chained to his bedside. And where he feels useless to her. And then, you know, Bess's mother-in-law is saying, like, do not upset the men of the church. Like, without the church, you are nothing. Without the church, you are a ghost. And so she is, you know, telling Bess to obey the men of the church, who are telling her to obey her husband. And so you can see that everyone is acting in a way that they feel will protect this young woman. Yet still, again, terrible things happen to her and in the situation. And I think that the only sort of people in the film and in the opera who are acting in a way that is not good are these two sadistic sailor characters. But they're sort of comically sadistic, you know, and I think of it as if all the sort of malevolence of all the other characters is kind of concentrated in those two characters, who are just 100% bad. You know, they're sadists. They're like not great dudes to run into. But really, I do think everyone else in the film and in the opera is acting in a way that they feel is good. And that was a very interesting place to start from. That really came directly from Lars von Trier.
Now, this production by Tom Morris, I believe, debuted in Edinburgh. I think it was in 2019. And so the Detroit performance is going to be the U.S. premiere of this production. What do audiences expect to see in this production?
Well, this production is a really, it's a massive production. Like, it literally, the set is very large and imposing and gorgeous. And it operates on a turntable. So you know, the opera has a lot of very quick changes from the church to the seaside to a graveyard to the inside of someone's house to the hospital. We're constantly shifting, even though we're always within this sort of claustrophobic world of this community on the Isle of Skye. So Tom Morris has done a brilliant job at reflecting that. And it's also in combination with our amazing projection designer, Will Duke, who has just created magic. I remember the first time I saw these projections, and it's like my brain couldn't make sense of what I was looking at. It was so extraordinary. So there's really beautiful sort of, you know, theater magic happening in this set, which I don't see so much in a lot of opera. I see it a lot in plays and on Broadway, but I was really happy to bring some of that into the operatic world, into this piece. But, you know, Tom Morris is a very musical director, and he's approaching everything from the music, you know, which it sounds like an obvious thing to do with opera, but not every director works that way. And he's really gone deeply inside this story and reflected it psychologically in every way.
All right. Now, Keira Duffy, who premiered the role of Bess back in 2016, is coming to return here, coming to Detroit for this production. What does it mean to have her back in this production after 8 years?
So it is so special to have Keira back in this role. You know, I wrote this role initially for her. You know, she was with me even before I'd finished the piece. You know, she was trying things out and singing through fragments and giving me feedback on the role. So the role really fits her voice. Keira is also one of the smartest, most, you know, inquisitive, brilliant singers I've ever worked with. I mean, she's just, it's almost freaky. It's just like, I don't know how she does it. But it was such a joy to work with her on this production initially. So I'm really thrilled that she's bringing it back. And I can only imagine that her performance will deepen, you know, after 8 years. And after witnessing the incredible journey that this piece has had, I think she'll bring something really special to it.
Fantastic. Now, my last question to you is that, you know, of course, I know you spent some time in Detroit previously. I know you did some things with the DSO, and I believe you brought your electroacoustical band here to Detroit for performances. What is it like coming back to Detroit, or what are you thinking about as you prepare to return here?
I'm so excited to come back to Detroit. You know, it's like I've done performances in Detroit over the years. My band has performed there twice. Once at the DIA, the room with the Diego Rivera murals, which was a really special performance for us. And then earlier on our very first tour, we ended our tour in Detroit at a place called the Contemporary Art Institute of Detroit, which was like kind of like a house that had an art gallery and had bands play in it. And it was so delightful and raw and fun. And then I've also, you know, done concerts with the Detroit Symphony over the years and written works for the Detroit Symphony. And I love the town. You know, I love the energy of Detroit. I love the art that's happening in Detroit. I love the music and the art that's happening on the street, the visual art. It's just a really inspiring place. And I mean, so I'm very excited to bring an opera there. This is the first time we'll have brought an opera to that town, and I couldn't be happier.
Missy, we are so thrilled that you are bringing this opera to Detroit. What do you expect Detroiters to take away or experience from this opera?
Well, you know, I'm always interested in creating art that leaves people with more questions than answers. And that might be infuriating to some people, but I hope that Detroiters will come with an open mind and be willing to engage in these big questions. You know, opera is a place for big ideas and big questions. So this is an opera about the nature of goodness. What does it mean to be a good person? The nature of faith. Does faith have limits? What are the limits of someone's faith in the face of a great tragedy? And, you know, how strong are the bonds of love in that tragedy? And are there limits to that? And I think that these are things that we've all thought about in some way and that can relate to our own lives. So I really, my experience of presenting art in Detroit is that people are very open and very engaged. And so I'm really looking forward to that. And I'm thrilled that this is the first city in America where this production will happen. So in a sense, I don't know how people are going to react. I'm really glad that it's happening for the first time in Detroit, because I know we're going to have some good conversations.
Missy, what a pleasure it has been to speak with you today. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Christine Gerke, thank you so much for joining me today. It was quite a pleasure for you to be a guest today.
I was so happy to chat with you about this piece. It means so much to me. And thank all of you, for everyone who is listening, to get a glimpse into Detroit Opera's production of Breaking the Waves. We hope that we can see you at the Detroit Opera House for this very exciting production, which opens on April 6th and runs through April 14th at the Detroit Opera House.
To purchase tickets to Breaking the Waves or to find out more information about the production, visit our website at DetroitOpera.org. You can also connect with us on social media on Facebook, Instagram, and X. And thanks to Jake Neer and Matthew Principe for their assistance in producing this podcast, and we'll see you at the opera.